this man was now moving, once we thought he was moving into sort of this territory that other people didn't from our neighborhood, now we recognized that he was moving into a territory that very few people in the world did. Revenue generating was becoming incalculable. This was sort of the money-making machine that just could not be stopped.
There was a change when things became much more public, and that created a big problem for my father.
I think that in Northern Ireland, it was very easy to attract suspicion that you were getting dodgy money.
My name is Roma Downey, and I'm on the trail of a secret backroom broker. Those who know him best believe he may have helped change the course of history. What we know so far is that this apparently normal elderly man, now 90 years of age, in the past had a front row seat with world leaders and was involved in countless clandestine encounters in darkened corridors in Ireland, north and south. Importantly, he had inordinate amounts of money at his disposal. But where did it come from? Was it shady, as some began to suspect? Was he some sort of double agent? And how did it all disappear, leaving him with nothing? This is Chuck's Secret Box, Episode 2. And to find out more, we're going to go back in time when Chuck was about to graduate from high school. This is Chuck's nephew, Tommy Fitzpatrick.
Chuck was somebody who was not going to be confined to the local surroundings. He needed to get to different places. Somebody that just needed more than just a local security in a neighborhood. And while he appreciated that sort of thing, I don't think that was going to be for him.
In 1948, the U.S. Air Force beckoned Chuck, and at the age of 17, he signed up and trained as a radio operator. Chuck was sent to signals intelligence at the southern tip of Japan, but in his letters home, he was never allowed to disclose what he was doing. Then in 1950, when the Korean War broke out, his squadron's task was to intercept radio communications used by the Russians flying over the Sea of Japan. It was a covert and highly pressurized operation. After 4 years' service, he made his way back to his family home on Palisade Road in New Jersey, where he could be found at the kitchen table, tap, tap, tapping in Morse code. It was then that a new opportunity presented itself.
In the White House at Washington, President Roosevelt approves legislation to provide for America's war veterans in the peace to come. By law, federal loans, free schooling, job insurance, and complete rehabilitation are among the benefits assured every man and woman in the service.
At that time, the servicemen were allowed to go to university, and their tuition was paid by the GI Bill. So Chuck took advantage of that, and he wound up going to Cornell University, which was a super academic university in upstate New York. Academically, he was on an equal with people that were kind of groomed to be sort of Ivy League type people, and he was not going to be anything less than that, and he was going to be driven to be a successful guy. When he started to get into hospitality and hotel management, he recognized that the world is going to start to expand especially because of airline travel. So I think he was extremely aware of a budding industry that was about to explode after World War II. And at Cornell, he was at that time very energetic and always thinking of things, and he became pretty famous up there as the sandwich man, and he used to go around and sell peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and he pretty much always was in sort of a money-making or a revenue-generating mode.
He certainly passed on a very strong sense of the value of a dollar.
This is one of Chuck's five children, Leslie.
He always said to me, always growing up, you make your luck. You make your own luck. And he always used to say, the harder you work, the luckier you get.
As they say, fortune and love favor the brave. And Chuck found both after he graduated from Cornell and decided to try his luck in Europe.
He decided to go to Europe, and he ran into a fellow that he enjoyed his company very much in the south of France, Dr. Morali. And he was a very bright guy who actually was a leader in the French resistance and the French underground. And one day that fellow asked him to come to his house, and he had a daughter, Danielle, and Chuck fell in love with Danielle, and then eventually that led to a marriage.
While living on the French Riviera in the south of France, Chuck quickly seized upon a business opportunity when he saw there was a market to sell cut-price goods to the US servicemen sailing in the Mediterranean.
Back at the infant days, they were selling liquor and cigarettes to servicemen. So the movements of the ships was a secret. So you didn't know whether they would be in Barcelona or Naples or Villefranche or some of the other ports. So trying to find out where the ships would come to port was a tricky business. And Chuck would find out where the ships were because the prostitutes and the hookers always knew where the boats were going to come in. So Chuck was always one of these people that had his ear to the ground. And once he got on those ships, he came on with a suitcase full of brochures, and they would show pictures of, they used to call them five packs. They could buy five bottles of liquor in a five pack, like Johnny Walker or Jameson. And these prices were at a steep discount because there was no tax paid on it, but they couldn't actually acquire the goods. They would purchase a coupon, and then they would redeem that coupon back in the port in America when they got back to their home base. And those coupons actually became a form of currency in the poker games with the servicemen on the ships. The critical thing was there was no inventory, so Chuck would actually, he was actually getting paid for liquor that he didn't pay for. So it was an incredible windfall of revenue that just didn't appear to have any kind of ceiling to it. So there was always a certain amount of gray area as far as the legality, because the countries, of course, were not that happy because they were not receiving taxes. I know that Danielle and he had originally gone to Liechtenstein, and that was kind of like a Swiss tax haven type place, and they had a register of their corporate entity at that time, which was Tourist International.
Chuck pinpointed Liechtenstein because the banking and tax regulations there were almost non-existent. And he and his wife checked into the Wald Hotel in 1959, where Chuck set up the headquarters of Tourist International in two small rooms. However, to keep the police off their backs, they had to pack their bags and check out once every 7 days to avoid looking like they were overstaying their legal welcome. At this point, Chuck decided to join forces with a fellow Cornelian who he had come across in Barcelona. Bob Miller had been in the year above and had been working the Ritz reception desk there, but he was getting bored and packed in the job to join forces with Chuck. Where Chuck could easily blend into the background, Bob stood out from the crowd, and together they seized upon another exciting venture.
Eventually, they started to get interested in selling cars. Evidently, servicemen at this point now had available cash, and they really didn't have that many expenses, so the car business came into play. So in addition to bringing brochures with pictures of alcohol and cigarettes, they also showed cars and watches and other things that they could somehow entice the servicemen into purchasing. So that's kind of where it all began.
But the laws that be soon caught up with Chuck, and in March 1961, the Liechtenstein authorities had had enough of Chuck's presence there. So in a midnight flit under the cover of darkness, Chuck and his entourage escaped and drove hundreds of miles across Europe, getting border guards to turn a blind eye as they crossed the Swiss, the Italian, and the French borders to get to Monaco, the Mediterranean city-state, which was a mecca for foreign business people. And without a work permit, Chuck set up a new office on the quiet street of Rue Saffron-Raymond and was interested in yet another business venture.
Who ever heard of an airline that goes around the world twice a day, every day? Ever heard of an airline with 87 first-class entrees? Pan Am makes the going great. The airline is the world's most experienced airline. The airline that's going places like you've never gone before.
Now, the middle class of America was becoming very affluent to the degree where airplane travel also exploded.
And in 1961, Chuck bought out a company called Duty Free Shoppers, which targeted American tourists with the world's best perfumes, watches, scarves, cashmere sweaters, leather goods, and anything else they wanted to get their hands on, all sold at discount price.
So they actually had their first physical location of a duty-free shop in the Honolulu airport. And then they got a second one in the Hong Kong airport. And they really couldn't even handle the amount of orders that they were getting. And the story was that they would get so much cash that there were armored cars that used to have to go there and take out the cash twice a day or, you know, some periodic unheard of amount of times because the cash was pouring in so quickly, you know.
Then in 1964, when Japan eased its foreign travel ban, some 20,000 Japanese tourists were allowed to go abroad for the very first time.
It was the perfect storm of being in the right place at the right time. So my brother Jimmy, after he had graduated from college, Chuck called him to the south of France, and sure enough, Jimmy started to go on Chuck's sort of roller coaster of locations. And at this point in time, Chuck had many businesses. And of course, Duty Free was the machine that was making these other businesses start. And so Jimmy was one of Chuck's soldiers that would go anywhere and go anytime to any kind of assignment that Chuck might have. And Chuck also had many, many people like my brother Jimmy who all thought that Chuck is somebody that you wanted to help under any circumstances, because you thought in the back of your mind that Chuck was doing important things.
Millions upon millions poured into their bank accounts as luxury duty-free grew exponentially. And over the 1960s and 70s, the business expanded to 14 locations around the world. But Chuck, Bob, and their associates made sure to keep hush about all of the international currency they were raking in. For one, it kept their rivals in the dark and gave them a competitive edge. But second, and more importantly to Chuck, he was only too aware of the danger that notorious wealth could bring. Leslie, his daughter.
My father's always wanted really people to respect his privacy. And his family's privacy, really. I think he wanted to protect us.
He had seen other colleagues who became very successful, and their families suffered because the children were pursued for their money. I think he wished to safeguard them from the bad things that can happen to families that are notoriously wealthy.
That was Ed Walsh, founder of the University of Limerick, and we'll hear more from him soon. But one thing they're both getting at is in Italy during the 1970s, the kidnapping of children for ransom was rife. And at that time, Chuck, Danielle and their five children lived just 30 miles from the Italian border in France. Gangs were targeting children of the rich, and sometimes even when the $1 million ransom was paid, the children still got killed. So as well as keeping quiet about their wealth, Chuck was adamant that his children would not visit Italy until they were fully fledged adults. And that wasn't the only guidance he shared with them. Daughter Juliet.
I mean, he thought it was interesting, brands, of course, he sold brands. But as far as we were concerned and his children were concerned, you know, we shouldn't like brands, we shouldn't, you know, wear brands, even though, you know, logos were part of Dad's world. But I was turning 18 and I really, really wanted a Louis Vuitton bag, a small Louis Vuitton bag. And my cousin had one. I thought it was really cute. My father had connections, of course, because of the whole sort of luxury duty-free world. He knew the owner and everything. So my mother, for my 18th birthday, I got to go and buy a bag. I remember I went with my grandmother. And, well, when I wore it for the first time in front of my father, he went livid. Livid. I mean, he was furious. There was a little bit of a disappointment every time I wore that bag. I felt guilty. I was a little mad that I felt guilty because I did think it was my 18th birthday. And I have to say, from that moment on, I mean, I hate logos.
So to get this straight, Chuck, the maverick mastermind behind making luxury goods a must-buy across the world, wanted his own children to see through the illusion of advertising. And despite the $1 million in his bank account, he was adamant that his kids weren't going to get a handout.
You know, we all had to get summer jobs early, you know, whether waitressing or...
Yeah, I remember him sitting down with us at age 12, 13 and teaching us how to write checks and open bank accounts and saying, okay, there's your money, and making us kind of in charge of our own finances very early on, having to produce budgets and having them approved by him, and, you know, so that the money would be there. And then if anything was on the budget that was not appropriate, you know, so I remember in college putting in my budget money to buy a car, and he kind of laughed me off the thing and said, explained to me that I needed to go and get a job, which I did.
But he didn't just put this budgetary constraint on his children. He put it on himself. It seemed the richer he was becoming, the more frugal he became. And his nephew Tommy saw this happen right in front of his eyes.
It was a mental recognition that he didn't need material things anymore.
But as these thoughts and feelings were growing in Chuck's mind, speculation about his wealth made him front page news in 1988. And Neil O'Dowd, founder of the magazine Irish America, who thought Chuck looked more like a travelling salesman, was left stunned.
I had found out that Chuck was incredibly wealthy in the meantime because Forbes magazine had revealed him, I think, as about the fifth richest person in America. And I remember calling him up and said, my God, you're full of surprises. And of course, he said, don't believe everything you read in the papers.
There was a change when things became much more public. When Forbes listed him for the first time in their wealthiest people issue. And that created a big problem for my father. I think coming out of into the limelight was probably not great for my dad, especially since he hadn't planned it, I think.
He was very annoyed that his cover had been blown, that his anonymous title had been taken away.
To set the record straight, it was a 1988 edition of Forbes magazine which outed Chuck in its 400 richest people list, estimating his worth at $1.3 billion. But there was something else that Chuck was trying to hide, something much bigger, something that no one knew about, not even his business partner, Bob. But we'll come to that. At the same time as this news splash, Chuck, of Irish American stock, was starting to strengthen his ancestral ties with Ireland and enter into uncharted waters. Tommy Fitzpatrick.
Chuck had started getting involved with an organization that he set up with a fellow named John Healy called the Irish American Partnership. And for a time period, Chuck would be completely focused on anything Ireland, anything Irish. And he was part of a group of, I think there were 50 wealthy Irish American descendants. And I think that collectively they got together and they decided to make massive investments in places in Ireland.
The Irish American Partnership was an organization that a group of business people and myself created after the dreadful Brighton bombings and the sustained bombings in the UK in 1985. We founded this group, and the objective was to bring together the two traditions in North America, the orange and the green, with a view to stimulating activities that might result in peace.
A Remembrance Day atrocity in Northern Ireland. A bomb has killed 11 and injured more than 60. It was planted a few yards from the war memorial in Inniskillen. It went off without warning as the Remembrance crowds were gathering. They were civilians, Catholic and Protestant, young and old, there with their wreaths to remember.
I mean, another strong memory for me is his response to the Inniskillen Remembrance Day bombing in 87, and how angry and upset he was, and how he swore that in his lifetime he would do everything he could and throw everything he had at a peace process.
While positive investments in Ireland were being made by Chuck and the Irish American Partnership, word on the street was that some American money coming to Irish shores was making the situation much worse. Ed Walsh.
I knew he was appalled at the atrocities that were taking place in the name of Ireland by the terrorists. And in the early days, of course, he would have just been mixing in the Irish-American community. And he would have been concerned about some of the funds that were being raised by NARAID, which were going to buy guns, quite likely. And he would have been disturbed by that and would have seen the result of US funds being given, perhaps by people, well-intended people, but they're resulting in the purchase of weapons of destruction. He would have abhorred that and have wished to do something about it.
Neil O'Dowd.
There were some signals coming to us from Ireland that political change was about to happen. It was a time that John Hume was getting together with Gerry Adams, and there was a lot of movement in terms of people saying things could be different. So what we had decided to do was put together a group of people who would go over to Northern Ireland. This is the early 1990s, and Chuck particularly was very interested in the idea of, you know, working towards peace from an American angle. So I had a number of people with me, like Chuck, like Bill Flynn, like Bruce Morrison, who had a very deep sense of involvement in Ireland in one way or another, and who felt, is there anything we could do in terms of working with people to increase the chances of peace?
You know, the way he got involved, it needed discretion. It needed, you know, we didn't really find out this whole story until afterwards.
We had gone to the White House and said, look, we think we can work with the different parties over there. We think we can help bring about an American dimension that would be very helpful. So we talked about this theory of outside the box, where people were locked into positions and couldn't move from those positions. And then you bring in somebody from the outside and the people have to change their relationships. We were the instigators of it at the start. We were dealing with Sinn Féin throughout that period very intensively. So we had worked with them on an unannounced ceasefire for 7 days when we went over in September of 1993. And they were willing to ask the IRA to stop any operations for a week while we were there.
Only the White House and the Irish-American delegation would know of this ceasefire. And during this week, the group started to engage in backdoor diplomacy. First, they met Irish Prime Minister Albert Reynolds before they drove to Stormont Castle to meet the Northern Ireland Secretary Sir Patrick Mayhew. And then they met all of the political parties of Northern Ireland, but from Reverend Ian Paisley, they were met with suspicion. Susan McKay.
Well, I suppose the suspicion among unionists would have been that, a lot of money coming in from the United States was probably something to do with Irish republicanism. And of course, the fact that Chuck did give some funding to support Sinn Féin in America subsequently would have added to those suspicions.
Next time.
In terms of Northern Ireland, Chuck was completely fearless. He didn't care about criticism. He knew he was doing the right thing by going the final step.
I was not pleased with his decision. At the time, it seemed absolutely wrong.
And what about the big secret Chuck was hiding? A secret so big that when it came out, everyone would be talking about it, including Bill Gates. Yes, that Bill Gates, founder of Microsoft.
I was aware that there was a big anonymous donor, but I didn't really understand the story.
To get the next episode and more in the Assume Nothing series, go to BBC Sounds, or you can download the app and hit subscribe.